It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Ukrainian President Zelensky is heading home after a surprise visit to Washington, D.C. yesterday. We'll talk about his meeting with President Biden and what he said to a joint meeting of Congress. First, some lawmakers have been making the case in recent years for the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, a bill that could eventually lead to a legal status for undocumented farm workers in the U.S. There was a last-ditch effort to pass the legislation as part of a year-end omnibus spending bill. Looks like it didn't make it, though. As some farmers struggled to retain workers, the Farm Workforce Modernization Act was aimed at helping farmers who need year-long help as well as seasonal help around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you operate a farm yourself, do you rely on workers from other countries, undocumented or otherwise? Were you watching the progress of this law? Whoever you are, wherever you are, what do you want to know about the status of farm workers in the country, what this act could have done, other changes that could be in the works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Costa is the Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. He focuses on U.S. immigration law and policy, international labor migration, farm labor, and forced migration. Daniel, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's been this Farm Workforce Modernization Act has been in the works over the course of a few years. We've talked to you about it before. There was this last-minute push between, I think, when we reached out to you and today. What ended up happening in the home stretch?
Sure. It appears there just weren't enough senators that were willing to support the legislation because of the filibuster rules in the Senate. You needed at least 10 Republican senators to support it. And from all the reporting that's out there, it's just clear they didn't have enough. It seems like they came close. Maybe they had six or seven senators who supported it, but they couldn't get all the way to 10. And thus it didn't get a standalone vote. It didn't have the votes to get attached to the omnibus spending package that just passed the Senate.
Give us the basics. What would the Farm Workforce Modernization Act do if it were to be passed?
Sure. It has three main elements. The first one is a legalization program for unauthorized immigrant farm workers. There's some work requirements, and it would take a number of years before they could get a green card, but it would give unauthorized farm workers an immediate kind of temporary status so they could continue to work. Sure. A second piece is it would make major changes to the H-2A visa program, which is the U.S.'s main temporary work visa program. One of the bigger changes is that it would include new visas for year-round. And it would make a number of changes to kind of the way the wages rule, the wages work in that program. And then finally, it would mandate the E-Verify program for agricultural employers nationwide. That is the federal government's electronic employment verification program. So there's a whole lot within those three buckets, but that's kind of the overarching broad framework of the legislation.
That year-round thing, it's of interest here in Wisconsin, as I understand it, and I think from past conversations with you, Daniel, a lot of the law surrounding this regards seasonal labor, kind of important in Wisconsin, more important elsewhere. Dairy states like Wisconsin, there's no dairy season, or it's always dairy season. Can you talk about that that non-seasonal part of the legislation?
Yeah, sure. And I should say, I actually grew up in a dairy town, had a lot of family members who worked on dairy. So I know the importance of the industry. And I mean, in Wisconsin, there are about 15 to 20,000 dairy workers on about I think it's about 1,200 dairy farms, at least according to the Labor Department's latest numbers. And
I'm going to cut in. Daniel, we're having some connection trouble. I think we're going to try reconnecting through another medium with you. We are talking to Daniel Costa with the Economic Policy Institute. We're looking at farm labor in the United States, undocumented farm laborers in particular, and a bill. It's been bouncing around in Congress for a while now. A version had passed the House. There was a last-ditch effort to pass it in this omnibus spending package. Didn't end up in there, though. The bill is the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, looking to provide some kind of legal status for those undocumented farm workers. It fell short. We're finding out why, what it means, what could happen next. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at 800- 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I think we're reconnected with Daniel. We lost you there, Daniel. The question you were tackling was the importance of that's non-seasonal, that year-round element of the Farm Workforce Modernization Act.
Sure. I was saying that that element of the bill is something that not just is important for Wisconsin, but a number of states have been lobbying and pushing for changes to the H-2A program in order to have year-round jobs. And so there are something like about 500,000 ag jobs nationwide. And so the way the bill worked is it started with kind of a low number, kind of an annual limit on the number of year-round jobs that the H-2A could fill. It would start at 20,000 for the first 3 years, and then it would go up by a certain number. And then after the 10th year, it might not have a limit anymore. So that was one of the most controversial aspects of the bill. It was one of the things that the employers wanted more of. There was some back and forth. I think one of the issues that kind of came up in this is that you're doing temporary visas for what are year-round jobs, and many, especially worker advocates, think that if you're bringing migrants in to do year-round jobs, they should get green cards and permanent residence, because that way they could stay permanently and work year-round rather than being in this temporary status that employers control.
Let's take a step back and look at the role of farm workers from other countries, documented or otherwise. How important are these workers in American agriculture?
They're absolutely essential. I mean, they make up probably something like 3/4 to 80% of the entire farm workforce is immigrants of who are either undocumented or coming in on visas or who were naturalized immigrants. So it's very much a very immigrant heavy industry. The industry really wouldn't function without immigrants. It's probably only somewhere between 20 and 30% of people who are U.S. born actually work in agriculture, and it's been that way for some time. I think that what's happened sort of over the years is there used to be a very much there was a higher share of the workforce was undocumented, but with all the border security that's happened over the previous years, what you've seen is a shift to using this H-2A visa program, which farmers have started to use in record numbers. We're up past 300,000 H-2A workers in the United States. That's more than triple what it was just about a decade ago.
Can you talk about some of the political alignments here? What kind of organizations, what kind of groups were advocating for this Farm Workforce Modernization Act and this more legal status for agricultural workers from other countries?
Sure. Well, you had some splits among the groups that supported it on either side. Groups who were out there either pushing for or against it were the major kind of agricultural associations that are out there, the Western Growers, the American Farm Bureau, and then kind of on the worker side, it was mostly the United Farm Workers who were negotiating this with farm owners. And there were some farm worker groups that didn't like the bill as much because of the expansion of the H-2A program, which many people, including myself, think is sort of flawed in the way that it's set up in terms of giving employers a lot of power over workers. And so it really both the support and the opposition to it was kind of split in terms of politically. Almost all Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, supported the bill, and you even had statements of support from President Biden, who supported the legislation as well and wanted its passage. So there was a lot of support for it. It was one of those bills where even under the Trump administration, there was a chance that it might pass just because, agriculture is such an important industry, and every single senator in the United States has agriculture in their state. And so that gives it a chance to pass, even though, there are green cards and a legalization in there, which some Republicans think they call amnesty, and they have been against it mostly for that reason.
Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Good afternoon. I just had a question. What do these workers get paid, and do they have housing involved? Because I guess I understand why they can't get regular citizens that are already here to do the work. Is it the conditions are so poor, that you pay is so poor? I just wondered about that.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. That is kind of at the heart of this. Why aren't American workers or people here already legally filling these jobs to begin with, Daniel?
Sure, yes. It's a great question, and it's one of the issues that's at the heart of the debate about this legislation. So farm workers in general are amongst the lowest paid workers in the entire U.S. labor market. One of the things that employers were claiming in terms of the need for this legislation was that wages are rising too quickly in agriculture, and they have risen maybe a little bit faster than regular than wages for other workers outside of agriculture. But the reality is that they have not even come close to getting to you know, where wages are for other workers who are outside of agriculture. So still some of the lowest wages in the entire U.S. labor market, right around the wages that workers who do not have a high school diploma earn. And so the H-2A workers who come in on visas, there are federal laws and regulations that set what those wages are set at. Each state has a different wage, and the way the wage is set is just by looking at survey data for agricultural farm workers that the USDA puts out every year. So every year there's a new wage, which is the wage that the employer is required to pay. And so in the legislation, in the bill, what the bill did is freeze the increase in wages for these H-2A farm workers for a year, and then it set limits on how quickly their wages could rise. And that was one of the things that employers wanted the most. But, you know, it really, you know, one of my criticisms of the bill is that it really restricts wage growth that should happen naturally for farm workers when there is, you know, a supposed labor shortage. You would expect wages to rise naturally, and that legislation really did a lot to not let those wages increase. Oh, and then the last thing, of course, is the H-2A program does require that employers provide housing for their H-2A workers, as well as transportation. And U.S. workers, if they apply for those jobs, are also entitled to that same wage and to that same housing and transportation if they live outside of the local area.
Thanks for that call, Jimmy. Daniel Costa is with us, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. We're talking with him about immigrant farm labor and the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which just fell short in the U.S. Senate this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Even though this failed this time around, would you like to see more access to legal status for farm workers from other countries here in the U.S., maybe those who are already working here but are undocumented? Do you work in agriculture yourself? Do you see a lot of undocumented workers in the business there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Daniel Costa, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. We're looking at farm labor in the United States, workers from other countries, often undocumented workers, key to agriculture here in the United States, and about the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, an effort to provide more access to legal status for some of those workers. It fell short in this big Senate year-end last-minute spending bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences. Maybe you've worked with or hired some of the workers we're talking about. Maybe you are one of the workers we're talking about. And even if you're not, you probably eat food once in a while. You may have an opinion on all of this. What do you want to see happen? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Daniel, you were talking before the break about labor costs for farmers. It's tricky because this is not a high margin industry. For a dairy farmer, say, well, milk prices, if they go up, great. But often that means feed prices have gone up, labor prices have gone up with inflation lately. There's not a lot of wiggle room for some of the employers we're talking about.
Sure, that's true. And even with when you're talking about crops and fresh produce and things like that, you know, the markup is often at the grocery store, and farmers and workers are getting small margins here, and that's absolutely understandable. But the solution to me is not to restrict and push down wages of workers who are already some of the lowest earners in the entire labor market. Of course, there needs to be a fair way to do that. But of course, employers need to make a profit in order for the business to work and to be able to keep employing people. So how you come up with that, what that balance is obviously something that needs to be figured out by Congress. That one solution was the way the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, but there are probably other ways to do it too.
I wanted to ask you about that, given that this year the Farm Workforce Modernization Act isn't going to happen. Congress is done. There's questions about whether it could happen now with the Republicans taking control of the House next month. Do you see other avenues to tackle some of these concerns?
At the moment, it's not looking like it. If it requires legislation that comes from Congress, I find it very hard to believe, unless it's something that doesn't include immigration or doesn't include legalization or doesn't include green cards for immigrants. I think the Republican-led House is just not going to entertain any issues like that at all. And I think that's why people were working very hard in Congress to try to get this attached either to the omnibus or to get a vote on it before the end of the year, because it's pretty clear that nothing along those lines is even going to be considered, really.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Eau Claire. Matt, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about, Matt?
Oh, I was just, here's what I want to bring to your attention or whatever have you. I'm a tradesman, and I learned my work ethic in 120 degree hay mound when I was a kid, you know, because that's the job that you had when you were 14 years old. And I'm just wondering, your comments as far as this subject goes, as far as why are those jobs not available to young men indigenous to this country? You know,
Matt, thanks for the call. Yeah, I don't know if farmers are looking for those teen workers for that kind of grueling, demanding work, Daniel.
Yes, I mean the H-2A program, employers are supposed to recruit and hire U.S. workers before they can go and hire someone from abroad, and that's an essential element of the program and should remain so, I think. It's tough to say. It's just been hard to attract U.S. workers to the jobs because of the low wages that I've mentioned, the low wages and the very tough conditions. I mean, farm work is by the numbers, some of the most dangerous work in the entire U.S. labor market, while being the lowest paid. So you can see that employers have been willing to the other workforce that's available to them is to go abroad. And so, I would like to see a world where conditions get improved and some more U.S. workers might want to take these jobs. But I'm not sure to what extent you could get there and what it would require in terms of improving wages and working conditions. But I do think that improving wages and working conditions would at least attract some workers, because many people think that that no Americans do these jobs, and that's just not true. The data from the Labor Department show that, you know, depending on the year, it might be 20 or might be 30% of the farm workers are actually U.S. born workers. So some probably would do these jobs if conditions were improved, but that's been an ongoing long-standing problem in agriculture.
Thanks for the call. Todd joins us now in Stevens Point. Todd, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Todd. You're on the air.
I was just questioning. You mentioned the lowest wages, but I didn't hear an actual number. And then you also mentioned the farmer employer needs to provide the housing. Is that housing on the premises of the farm? Or where exactly do they house the employees? And third question is, do these people pay taxes?
Todd, thanks for the call. I'm guessing the answer to the first two questions, Daniel, is going to vary around the country, the rate of pay and the housing. But do we have a sense of how those work out?
Sure. So I don't know what it is for Wisconsin. I'm sorry, I should check that. But nationwide, it's around $16 an hour was the wage for farm workers. And to put that into context, you know, almost every single Democrat in the House and Senate thinks that $15 should be the minimum wage across the board for everyone. So it's just above, you know, the minimum wage is even, you know, higher than that in some states. And so that's sort of the broadly the wages. And then in terms of the housing, it varies. You can have the housing on premises. Some employers do actually build housing on their location, or they often rent out entire hotels where they keep workers. It varies, and the state is involved in checking to make sure that the housing is up to federal standards. There are rules about the minimum standards for the housing. And in terms of taxes, that varies by state. A couple of states, including California, you do need to pay payroll taxes on H-2A workers, but federally you don't. So in a number of states, you actually don't have to pay the taxes on them.
Thanks for the questions, Todd. And Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Daniel Costa, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. He focuses on U.S. immigration law and policy, international labor migration, farm labor, and forced migration. He joined us today to talk about the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. It didn't make it through a threshold at the U.S. Senate, not going to pass, it looks like, this year. Coming up after the news, a Wisconsin political scientist shares results of a survey he conducted among Ukrainians this fall, showing their resolve for winning the war with Russia and not conceding any territory. And, of course, the visit of the Ukrainian president to the United States, his meeting with President Biden, and his address to both houses of Congress. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a longtime Milwaukee reporter about her story of grief and single motherhood after the sudden death of her husband and how she learned to grow through the trauma. Now, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky paid a surprise visit to the U.S. Capitol yesterday, meeting earlier in the day with President Joe Biden at the White House and addressing a joint meeting of Congress in the evening.
We have artillery. Yes. Thank you. We have it. Is it enough? Honestly, not really.
Zelensky came directly from a combat zone in Ukraine on Tuesday. During his visit, continued to wear wartime clothing, an army green sweatshirt, cargo pants, and combat boots. We're looking at the timing of his visit, what he hoped to accomplish, and where the war to get Russia out of Ukraine goes from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions, what reactions do you have to Zelensky's visit? What do you want to know about U.S. support for Ukraine, past, present, and future? What do you want to see the U.S. do to support Ukraine? Do you think there's been enough? Do you want to see more? What questions do you have about how this all ends? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be with you again.
Can you talk about why this visit and why now?
Well, I think it was interesting because there was not a lot of advance warning, as you know. It came together pretty quickly, sort of over the weekend with some planning, and then was really only announced right before Zelensky was in D.C. And I think there are a few things with the timing. I think one was there has been a little bit in Europe, but also a bit in the United States of some kind of rumblings in the political system from different people about maybe we, you know, need to cut back a bit on the aid to Ukraine and we got to focus on ourselves a bit. And as much as he's been very effective in the past with these addresses where he's speaking virtually, you just can't replace being in person. And I think it was a at times powerful and a very effective speech where he made the case for further aid. And I think made it much more difficult for people who were kind of calling that into question to continue with their positions.
Can you talk about some of his specific asks to the president and to Congress and how they match up with the current situation on the battlefield in Ukraine?
Well, I mean, first of all, I will say we've given a lot of aid to Ukraine. We've given not just military aid. There's been a lot of non-military aid. I think people don't pay enough attention to a lot of humanitarian and financial aid, and Ukraine still needs that. And I think in some of the meetings that were going on with advisors on both sides, I think that was still continued to be talked about. But there's been a real shift over the course of this war about the kinds of weapons Ukraine needs. Initially, we've talked about in the past, the sort of smaller weapons. We've sent over 10,000 total javelins and stingers to Ukraine. Those were really effective early on, but as the summer dragged into the fall, they just were less necessary. We needed Ukraine to have longer range battlefield munitions and things. That's when we started talking about the HIMARS system, which has been talked about in the past. And I think the big change for where we are today is really starting in October. You know, Russia just massively stepped up this launching of rockets and missiles at cities in Ukraine, often targeting the energy grid. I think it took some people a little while to realize, even though a lot of us were saying early on that seems to be the target, you know, kind of took a little bit for some people to realize it was not really going after civilians as much as going after them indirectly by going after the energy grid. So this has led to Ukraine wanting an increased ability to try to intercept those rockets and missiles, and increasingly worried about these Iranian-made drones, which have been very effective as well for Russia.
And President Zelensky made the case that, yes, this is help for Ukraine, but it's bigger than that. Here's a listen.
Your money is not charity. It's an investment in the global security and democracy that we handle in the most responsible way.
Can you talk about that, something at stake even bigger, and that it's still important, even bigger than the survival of Ukraine and Ukrainian people, that this has consequences for the United States?
Yeah, I thought he was very smart in really not only kind of leading them with that, but continuing to come back to it in the speech. That this was really, he said at one point, this sort of a broader fight, you know, for freedom over tyranny. This isn't just a, as you said, Ukraine-Russia conflict. The other thing about that in terms of some political context is, earlier this week, Mitch McConnell said something actually quite similar, which was interesting, where he basically said, you know, there's a kind of moral argument for this, but there's also just a really, you know, nuts and bolts American national security interest reason for doing this as well. And I think that the Zelensky speech sort of went beyond that, but it also built on that idea that this is in our interest too. It's not just something we're doing, as Zelensky said, out of a sense of charity.
We are talking to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University about Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's visit to Washington, D.C. tomorrow, address to both chambers of Congress, and the latest in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, what you want to see from U.S. policy there, your questions about what's going on in the war, what it would take to end it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lowell, you mentioned the targeting of power plants, very wintry here in Wisconsin now, the same in Ukraine. Here is President Zelensky talking about the impact of that and Ukrainian resolve.
In 2 days, we will celebrate Christmas. Maybe candlelit. Not because it's more romantic, no, but because there will be no electricity. Millions won't have neither heating nor running water. All of these will be the result of Russian missile and drone attacks on our energy infrastructure. But we do not complain. We do not judge and compare whose life is easier. Your well-being is the product of your national security, the result of your struggle for independence and your many victories. We, Ukrainians, will also go through our war of independence and freedom with dignity and success.
Lowell, he's speaking to Ukrainian resolve there under incredibly difficult conditions. You actually conducted surveys of people in Ukraine just a couple months back. Did what you find matched up with what the president of Ukraine was suggesting there?
Yeah, it did. We actually had a few things that we were kind of expecting, but I think I was still surprised at the strength of the unity of the Ukrainian population in a few ways. And we asked both, you know, sort of closed-ended questions where they had to choose among some responses, but also allowed them to just speak openly and freely in their own words. And those were really powerful things that they said about how, you know, this, they see this as a fight for the survival of their nation, for their own identity. And when when a war is ultimately about identity, it allows the side that has been attacked to, you know, be more effective in its mobilization. It is really seen by a lot of Ukrainians as, you know, this is not just about our territorial control. It's about our very lives and the survival of the Ukrainian identity.
We've seen some outsiders from around the world say, okay, if we want peace, it might require some territorial concessions from Ukraine. Crimea, parts of the Donetsk region that had been effectively controlled by Russia in some ways, even before the invasion. You asked specifically about that in surveys. What did Ukrainians say?
We did. And these were some of the most stunning responses. We asked a couple different versions of the same question, sort of asked them with opposite wording. So if you're answering consistently, you know, you would strongly agree with one and strongly disagree with the other. And that's what happened. They were consistent, they were unified, and it was in the range of 90 to 95% of the Ukrainian people basically held this position that there will be no territorial concessions, that the only acceptable outcome is a complete victory that involves Russian withdrawal from all territory of Ukraine, including Crimea, which again is a really, really strong position to take. And what's interesting is in some ways that gives Zelensky a little bit of leverage in his negotiations with Russia. He doesn't have the situation where he can say my people are open to compromise here. On the other hand, again, it's a limiting thing, right? It constrains what he can do politically within his own country. I think he's been masterful in his execution of the army offensives and the defensive actions that have been taken from a military standpoint, but also just incredibly successful at mobilizing and rallying his people. And I think he's in a way a victim of his own success there, that he has made people believe that Ukraine can win this war. And as a result, they are not going to easily accept territorial concessions to Russia at this point.
Well, staying on the idea of Ukraine giving up territory, the notion that, okay, if Ukraine gave up Crimea, some of its eastern part to Putin, and then Putin would say, okay, I'm happy now. I have all the land I want for Russia. I mean, that seems naive to think that, given the pretext he's given for invading Ukraine could apply to other parts of the former Soviet Union or other parts of the Russian Empire. That doesn't really sound like a road to lasting peace to me.
I think that's a fair point. I think we think back to the beginning of the war and the way he talked about this and why the initial attack was on Kyiv, which was about removing what Putin called a Nazi government. You know, there was this theme of denazification of Ukraine. And so I don't know if he would be satisfied. I think at this point he would, in the short run, take that as a victory that he could point to with his own people. But he also has his own constraints that again are somewhat of his own doing, which is he has really kind of leaned on and unleashed Russian nationalism. And the Russian nationalists are, if anything, quite critical of this war from it not being aggressive enough in how it's been approached so far. And so, again, I it would be interesting for him to have to sell, really only getting what they already had after 2014, after all this, right, which would be Crimea and that eastern part of Donetsk and Luhansk. It would seem like he has to offer the Russian people something more than that as well. So both presidents are really in a difficult situation where there's not an overlap in what they can probably effectively pitch to their own people as a win from at least a territorial control standpoint.
We're talking about Ukrainian President Zelensky's surprise visit to Washington, D.C. yesterday and the current state of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Our guest is Marquette University political science professor Lowell Barrington, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch that address to Congress last night? What did you think? What do you want to see come out of this? Do you see a path to peace? Do you have questions for our guest about what's going on in U.S. policy there? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at the state of the war in Ukraine and President Zelensky's visit to Washington yesterday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments, your questions for our guest. Let's bring on a caller now. Charlie is with us in Beaver Dam. Charlie, hi.
I don't know who I heard it from. It was probably on yours or WPR. But I heard that there's rare metal earths in the eastern part of Ukraine, and that is what the main reason for the attack is. They want the land for the rare metal earths. And I also heard that Afghanistan, Russia was there 12 years before we were. And I was told from someone that was stationed over there that they have the largest deposits of lithium left in the world,
Charlie,
in Ukraine.
Thanks. I gotcha. Thanks for the call, Charlie Lowell. Is this in part a resource war on Russia's part?
It is. I mean, I will say I've heard less of that narrow kind of sense of the resources in question, but there is certainly a view of eastern Ukraine as having more of the kind of industrial economic base of Ukraine initially. Although, again, there's been an awful lot of destruction as a result of the war, so there will have to be a lot of repair and efforts to rebuild Ukraine after the war, regardless of which country is controlling that area. There's also a lot of agricultural production in the eastern part of Ukraine. I think we think of the western part of Ukraine as the more agricultural area, but the what's called the kind of black earth, the really rich soil areas of Ukraine include a lot of the east as well. So I think there were some economic calculations. Ultimately, this war has been in a lot of ways about identity from the start, and that's also on the Russian side. I think on the list of things that Putin does really deeply believe, I think that he believes to some extent that Russians and Ukrainians are one people, as he's said and written about. And I think that he felt like this was an area that Russia really just had a right to historically and today.
Charlie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lowell, in a memo you sent out with your survey results from Ukraine, you talk about some of the conditions for peaceful resolution of conflict. You mentioned an overlap in negotiating positions between the two parties. That doesn't seem to be in place here. One side winning a decisive war militarily and making the other side retreat and give up. That seems like a tall order for either side. What could be a path to a peaceful resolution here?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think one thing we do need to also think about is the role of the Western alliance in all this and to what extent they remain solid in their support of Ukraine. That while it does mean the war is prolonged, it also means Ukraine doesn't have to as easily think about making concessions because they are getting support. Ultimately, in a lot of ways, I think we can't expect a diplomatic solution anytime soon. I think if Putin were to be removed or were to die in one way or another in office or something like that, maybe the door would be open. But again, as we've talked about in the past, I think that the danger there is we don't know what we're going to get after Putin and Russia either. And it could be someone who's actually even more of a Russian nationalist than Putin seems to be a lot of the time. So I'm not optimistic. I think Putin's strategy in all this is literally to sort of starve and freeze Ukrainians this winter and force them to negotiate. That is why they're going after the electrical grid and water supplies and things like that with these missile strikes. And I think as much as we're dealing with a weather situation here that's a real serious thing, and it's in the 30s in Ukraine. It's warmer there than here right now, but they are dealing with not these just kind of regularly scheduled rolling blackouts. They're losing electricity and heating for sometimes days at a time as the winter is about to get worse and worse. So I think that Putin believes that strategy has a chance to work. I don't think that's right. I think as Zelensky has made clear, the Ukrainian resolve is not going to be broken by those kinds of actions.
And staying with the humanitarian impact, you were just talking about, of course, people going out without water, without electricity. We've also seen dire consequences when territory and when people fall into Russian hands there. What do we know about war crimes, atrocities, people throwing around the word genocide?
That's not only being exposed as Ukraine has grabbed more territory back from Russia in the conflict, where they've taken towns and have been able to actually locate and find these mass graves in some of the cities that from territory they've reclaimed. But there's also been good work done on using satellite photos and different things around cities that Russians are in control of, and seeing the digging of huge trenches and mass graves, and then filling them back over, that people have been cataloging as well. I will say I don't want to portray this as a one side is the only evil side and the other side's just doing everything perfectly well. I'm sure we will discover that Ukraine at times took actions in the heat of the battle that we would not want to have been them doing as well. But it is, as a whole, it's been a largely one-sided thing in that regard. And I think we're going to continue to find that after the war. This will be a kind of horrific part of history for this part of the world for decades down the road, in terms of the slow rollout of what people will find year after year.
Talking to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University with the latest on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Ukrainian president's visit to Washington, D.C. yesterday. Lowell, in response to that visit, we've seen statements from spokespeople for the Kremlin, the Putin administration, saying that this is a proxy war for the U.S., U.S. being willing to sacrifice Ukrainians, and saying it won't deter Russia from meeting its goals in Ukraine. What can we tell are the Russian goals in Ukraine at this point in the war?
That's a really, really good question, because, again, I think they've been changing. There is a sense in the short term right now that what Russia is doing is largely giving up on some of the areas in the south. So the area that Ukraine got back around Kherson, I think they are not trying to take, but they are trying to push more through Donetsk and Luhansk than they have control of right now. Actually, Zelensky mentioned in his speech this area of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine, and that's pretty far northeast into the Donetsk region. So this is an area that Ukraine has held on to. And I think, again, they are really looking for that in terms of Russia as an area to get control of, just from a kind of public relations victory standpoint. I think the other thing that they are trying to do in some ways is to get wins by taking out Ukrainian equipment when they can. And I will say that one of the things that a lot of people are focusing on is this decision to send a Patriot missile battery to Ukraine. And I do think it's, again, it was kind of a PR victory for Zelensky, but it will also be a very high priority target for the Russian military when that is up and running.
Lowell, what are you watching for in the next few weeks?
Well, domestically here, I think one of the things we're looking at is whether what we've seen in the U.S. Senate and in the bulk of the House of Representatives stays in place when the House switches over to Republican control in terms of the attitudes about aid. I will say I've been kind of frustrated with the rhetoric about the, we're not going to have a blank check for Ukraine. I think that's a really false kind of red herring type statement in the first place, that there's never been a blank check. We've always had to argue for and make a case for, as the American government, to others in the government and to the American people, about what we're doing in Ukraine. So I think that, that's one thing, though, that we will have to watch, is just to what extent there will be pressure to kind of cut back on support for Ukraine. And then I guess, again, in a not very uplifting way, I mean, I think the biggest thing to watch is just how the Ukrainians do survive and hang in there through this next weeks and months as the weather gets worse and worse and the missile and rocket strikes continue.
Lowell, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Lowell Barrington, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, with us to look at the war in Ukraine and break down what we heard from President Volodymyr Zelensky during a surprise visit to Washington, D.C. yesterday. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, school nurses are often at the front lines when it comes to spotting illness outbreaks among students and for treating those everyday bumps and bruises along the way. But there aren't enough of those nurses to go around, it looks like. Find out why some school leaders, some school districts are facing a nurse shortage and possible solutions. You can join in and tell us what you see in your own local school. That's coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show. Yesterday on the show, we talked about made-for-TV holiday movies. Here's a story about another movie that's become a Christmas classic on television, but only because of copyright law. It's a Wonderful Life is a standby movie to watch this time of year. A lot of people see it as the Christmas movie. But as reported in the Wall Street Journal, the movie was a flop when it was released in 1946. It was such a failure that when the copyright was set to be renewed 28 years later, nobody bothered. So It's a Wonderful Life entered the public domain in 1974, which meant that, hey, if you own a TV station or later a cable network, you could fill a couple hours for free by showing this forgotten film. Well, as we know now, it didn't stay forgotten for long. This couldn't happen today. Copyright laws have been changed. Movies stay copyright for 95 years. And in the 90s, the U.S. Supreme Court retroactively changed the rules to bring back some copyrights for It's a Wonderful Life. So the rebirth of It's a Wonderful Life will be a unique Christmas movie miracle. This is Central Time.